since last week. We've changed due to causes and conditions, but our life hasn't ceased in gross impermanence yet. So we're quite fortunate still to have this rebirth with all the opportunities to learn the Dharma and practice it. And so it's crucially important that we do, because with every action we engage in, we're creating the cause for our future experience. And since we all want happiness and we don't want suffering, we're the ones responsible for creating the causes of our happiness and not creating the causes of our suffering. And we do that in every single moment that we're alive. So it's not that we kind of have a time out where we can learn the Dharma and practice it and then create some good karma. Yeah. But the whole time we're learning and practicing, or sloughing off or being distracted, all that time we're creating the karma for our future experiences. And although our long-term aim is for full enlightenment, if we don't have a fortunate rebirth in the next life, it will be hard to continue practicing the path to enlightenment. And so, therefore, we should try to create the causes for a good rebirth, ethical conduct, and the six far-reaching attitudes and dedication prayers for that. But always do that within the context of aiming for full enlightenment. In other words, not being satisfied with just a good rebirth in samsara, because that too will end and doesn't leave us anywhere at the end of the day. You know, the only things that will really be satisfactory in terms of long-term bliss or happiness are nirvana and full enlightenment. So it's very important that we aim for those, and within them for full enlightenment, so that we'll have the ability to benefit all living beings most effectively. Do you ever stop and think during the day, am I ready to die today? Or how would it feel to die today? Yeah. And am I ready for that? And, you know, what am I going to do? Do I even know what to do? And, you know, can I let go of things in this life very quickly at the time of death? Or is my mind going to say, well, wait a minute, there's some more stuff I still have to take care of. You know? And so, really thinking about that. And especially, you know, at the time of death, then this life is just like a dream bubble, isn't it? Completely a dream bubble. You know, gone. Like just a, you know, you have... When you blow bubbles when you're a kid, there's a bubble, and you... And then it isn't there anymore. And that's the way it's going to be with this life, you know? The continuity of consciousness will go on, but it's not going to be the same person we are now, you know, in the sense of, you know, being whoever you're called right now with the same personality and the same... You know, because so much of what we are is due to our environment, too, is conditioned by our environment. And so we'll be in a whole different environment. Then are we ready for that? We have a hard time when anything changes that we didn't decide on, don't we? Yeah, we have an expectation that it doesn't happen. Then we get like really flustered and bent out of shape and like imagine at the time of death. Yeah, you know, we're not going to have any idea what's going to happen really unless we're pretty far advanced on the path. So, you know, remembering that throughout the day then makes us more thoughtful and helps us to see that, you know, each moment we've got to make meaningful as much as possible. Yeah. Instead of having a dream of when I get the perfect conditions, then I'll practice every moment. That's always a nice one to dream about, you know. The optimum excuse. Yeah? I can't practice now because, and when I have the, then I'll really, you know, every single moment. But meanwhile now, you know, I just don't have the right conditions, so I can't do it, so I won't try that hard. But, you know, the only time we ever have to practice is this very instant, you know. No matter what we're doing, if we're sitting here in teachings or walking in the woods or in the grocery store or, you know, walking down the street or chopping wood or whatever you're doing, you know, that's the only time we have to practice is that moment. And when are we all dream about the time when we have nothing more to do but practice Dharma. And when is that ever going to come? Yeah, as long as we have a body, we're going to have to do things to take care of this body, aren't we? Yeah? We're going to have to eat and bathe it and keep it sheltered and keep it clean and all these kinds of things. We have to do that, otherwise we're going to die sooner than expected. Yeah. So how do we make doing all those things that we have to do just to stay alive part of our Dharma practice when we're doing them? Yeah, you know, that's the really important thing, because we're never going to come to a time when there's nothing else to do. And if there is, we would probably just go to sleep, wouldn't we? But, you know, we have to sleep, too, for the health of this body. So how are we going to transform our sleep? And when we sleep, you know, when you go to bed, do you just let go? Yeah. Do we remember to dedicate before we, you know, go to sleep or to think of the Buddha or, you know, contemplate a teaching? Or do we just kind of collapse in a heap and say, oh, thank goodness. Yeah. I'm going to go unconscious now. And then we go unconscious and we aren't even awake to enjoy it. But we have to have it, otherwise we're unhappy. Isn't that peculiar? You know? We say, oh, I enjoyed sleeping, but we're not even awake, so how can we really enjoy it? Yeah? So, okay, so we're on the section here about emptiness, which is going to be something really good to try and think about at the time of death. Yeah, as we're clutching and clinging and holding on to everything and, you know, I can't die. It's too scary. I don't know what's going to come next. Show me the program. You know, I want to program what happens in what order. Because we like knowing what's going to happen, don't we? We feel more secure when we know. Who knows who's going to know? So we might get used to, you know, meditating on the death absorptions and be able to identify those. But, you know, when we hit the clear light and then go into the next life, there's not going to be any script. Or should I say there will only be the script that our karma is unfolding as. Okay, but if we can meditate on emptiness at the time of death, then we won't be so afraid of dying, and we'll realize that actually there's no person who's dying. We always think that there's a real me who's dying, don't we? I'm dying! Yeah, but that when you look, what's that I that's dying? Yeah? What is that I that's dying? Can you identify it? What's the I that's dying? Huh? Then we begin to see that there's no I that dies. Then you have to ask, well, is there an I that's alive? Because if you have an I that's alive, then that I's got to die. The eye doesn't die. Do you really have one that's alive? And here, what I'm talking about having an inherently existent eye, not just a labeled one, but a real one. If there's no real one that dies, is there a real me while I'm alive? Because it's not like there's going to be a real me, you know. I'm here and I'm in charge, and, you know, like this. And then at death time, oh, well, that just went out of existence. Yeah. If there's really an inherently existent I, then, you know, that kind of self is going to have a hard time dying because it can't change. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So it's interesting to think who's dying. I don't want to go out of existence. Who? Who am I to start with that I don't want to go out of existence? Yeah. What's the solid me that's alive that I'm afraid is going to get totally obliterated at the time of death? Because if there's no solid I that's dying, then there's not going to be a solid I when we're living either. So then why do we keep on asserting ourselves with this big I that's the center of the universe? Yeah. Really kind of pitiful, isn't it? You know? It's a big I that's walking around all day, filling the whole space. I was thinking the other day that it's almost amazing that we even hear the Dharma. Not that we have the situation to hear the Dharma. We have the situation. But that within that situation, we actually manage to hear what the Buddha's trying to say, you know, because our minds are so full of this notion of I and all of our ideas and all of our opinions and all of our emotions and everything we think the way it is, that how does any bit of Dharma ever get in there? Yeah? Given our capacity to misunderstand everything, yeah, to misunderstand it, or to reject it if we don't like it, or whatever. So given that we're so full of our own ideas and our feelings and our opinions and our views and how we think things are and how we think they should be, it's really amazing that when we sit in a Dharma teaching, that something actually can go in. Yeah? don't you think? It really is kind of amazing that something goes in. Anyway, let's try and increase the amount that goes in. And to do that, we have to kind of empty ourselves out of all of our junk, you know. So that's why you have the thing is the pot, you know, the upside down pot, the pot with the hole, but the pot that's filled with junk. Yeah, it's right side up, but it's filled with junk. No dharma can get in. Yeah, so that's us when we're all full of our ideas and our philosophies and feelings and our views and all that. And all these thoughts that are like going around all the time. So even paying attention to teachings is hard because the mind goes off during the teachings. And then, you know, what we do here, that it actually goes in, that's really kind of amazing. Really remarkable, I think. So while a little bit goes in, we should try and make it more. We should try and make it so it doesn't flow out the other end. We're not like a pot with the hole in the bottom. It goes in top and out the bottom. Or an upside down pot. You ever had that happen in teachings? I've had that happen when I'm sitting in the front row of teachings. Yeah? And this karmically created, like, heaviness comes in. A little embarrassing. That's a good way to use the eye at that time. That you get embarrassed, so that makes you try and stay awake. Because your reputation is at stake. So at that time, it's actually good that there's some attachment to the reputation. Now, they say the same thing about when they do the debating, you know, that sometimes the sense of I is what spurs them to study harder, you know, because if you're on the debate ground and you don't know your stuff and you can't think very quickly and so on, then you look like a real jerk. And so then the I doesn't like that, so then that makes you study harder. So they say there are some ways to use the clinging to the self. Okay. So we talked last time about the vessel, the ripe or receptive vessel to receive the teachings on emptiness. Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought the discussion at the end of it was a very good example of black and white thinking. Yeah. Don't you? Yeah, things aren't so black and white. Okay, so now we're on the part for the time for imparting the teachings. And last time we talked about when stability has been attained, impart the secret teaching. And so stability is referring to stability in the four preliminaries. And then the secret teaching here is the teaching on emptiness. Sometimes bodhicitta is called the secret teaching. Sometimes tantra is called the secret teaching. But here it's emptiness. Yeah, bodhicitta is the whole thought training teaching is sometimes called the secret teaching. The taking and giving practice, you know? Not only do you do that in secret, but just having the fortune to have that explained to you, not everybody can have that explained. It takes a certain kind of vessel even to hear that teaching on taking and giving, doesn't it? Because it can be scary. We're not scared by it because we don't get it. Yeah. But anyway, we keep trying. Okay, so in the context of training in the ultimate awakening mind, the text says, consider all phenomena as like dreams, examine the nature of unborn awareness, the remedy itself is released in its own place, and place the essence of the path on the nature of the basis of all. So there's those four phrases there. Okay, so it says here, and I really see where the translation, sometime, you know, I'll have to do a lot of explaining. The first line indicates the method for determining the lack of true existence of phenomena included amongst the objects that are apprehended by the mind. Okay, so the first line, consider all phenomena as like a dream, is actually a way that you meditate, that you're supposed to do in the post-meditation time. Okay, so you meditate on emptiness, and after you meditate on emptiness, then you practice seeing things as a dream. Here, it seems like you also, try and, even if you don't have a very good understanding of emptiness, while you're walking around all day, see things as like a dream. Yeah. Now, it's very important here when we talk about see things as like a dream or see things as like an illusion, that we remember that they're like a dream or like an illusion. They are not a dream. They are not an illusion. Okay? This is a very important distinction because, for example, when you dream, okay, and you don't create the if you dream of harming somebody in a dream, or you dream of receiving some kind of benefit or whatever, you're not creating the karma during the dream. You know, what karma you create is going to happen after the dream, whether you rejoiced in what you did in the dream or not. Okay, and if you hurt somebody in the dream, there's no real person there that gets hurt, so it's not going to be a complete action of harming somebody. But if you rejoice about it afterwards, you're going to get some mental karma of harming somebody. Okay? So things are like a dream in that they appear to exist one way, but they don't. But they are not a dream because in a dream there's no, objects there with which you can actually create karma. Okay? So things are like a dream. They appear one way, they exist in another way. Yeah, that's the meaning of it. Or when we say things are like an illusion, they appear one way, they exist in another way. Yeah? When you're in Disneyland and you're going out of the haunted house, at least maybe 40 years ago when you did, last time I was there, then as you're going in your car, you look in front of you, there's a mirror and there's a ghost sitting next to you. Okay? So, there's the appearance of a ghost, but there's not a real ghost. Okay? So in the same way, there's the appearance of true existence, but there's no truly existent thing. Yeah? So it's the metaphor is things appear, but they don't exist the way they appear. So the ghost appears real, doesn't it? Yeah. But there's no real ghost there. So things appear truly existent, but there's no truly existent things there. That doesn't mean that there's nothing there. It just means there's no truly existent thing there.
Does the dream affect your mind stream? Doesn't you have it because of karma, right? Like,
yeah.
Like if you've been violent, right? You have a lot more violence.
Right.
And then if you had a lot of violent dreams, wouldn't there be a karmic effect on your mind stream? I know you're talking about the actual karma of the action in the dream.
Yeah.
But
yeah, the dreams are related to karma in the sense that you know, like if we're doing a lot of purification or if we've done a lot of, you know, harmful things in the past, we're more likely to have nightmares and so on. And that's a ripening of karma. But still, there's nothing real there. This is where the analogy is getting. Okay? Yeah. That things appear, but they don't exist the way they appear. And so actually, in terms of karma, if you dream of having harm, and you think, oh, that's the negative karma ripening, that little bit of suffering I experienced in the dream is the ripening, then that helps to purify the actual karma that could really ripen as real harm. Okay? But let's keep to the analogy here, okay? Otherwise, we'll go into a whole discussion about creating dreams, creating karma in dreams, which isn't the purpose, okay? We're trying to stay now here on the whole idea that something appears, but it doesn't exist the way it appears, okay? When you look in a mirror, okay, it seems like there's a real person in the mirror, doesn't it? Very, very clear person in the mirror. And it's appearing, and it seems so real. Okay. Is there a person in the mirror? No. Is there the appearance of the person in the mirror? Yes. Is that appearance true, or is it false? It's false. Okay. So in the same way things appear truly existent, there's no truly existent thing there, but there is the appearance of an object. Okay? And that object appears in a false way, in that it appears truly existent, but it isn't. Okay? So there's no truly existent thing there, but that doesn't mean that there's nothing there. It's like with your sunglasses. There's no pink wall there, but there is a wall there. Okay? So this whole idea of things appear, you know, not existing in the way that they appear to us. Yeah. So we want to keep that kind of mindfulness as we're going around through the day. Okay? So to do that during the day, or to do that in our daily actions, then that understanding comes based on an understanding of emptiness. Okay? Because if we don't have some understanding of emptiness, then we're just saying everything's like a dream, everything's like a dream, but we don't really know what that means. And we're likely to start thinking everything is a dream, which could throw us over to a nihilistic extreme. Yeah? So we have to remember exactly what the analogy is getting at. Yeah? And when we do some analysis in our meditation session, looking for what the self is or what the object is, okay, then, and the not finding of the object, when we search for it in its basis of designation, then, after that, the fact that it still appears, but it appears to still have some existence out there, even though we know better, we know that it doesn't. Okay? So, you know, when a puppy sees a reflection in the mirror, the puppy thinks that there's another puppy there and tries to play with it. Okay? So that's like grasping at the true existence of something. We grasp that appearance as real and we try and engage with the truly existent object. Okay? But when you're older, you realize that there's the appearance of a face in the mirror, but there's no real face. So in a similar way, after you have a realization of emptiness, then after that, things appear truly existent, but you don't grasp at them as existing in that way. And instead you see them as existing like illusions in that they appear one way, but don't exist in that way. Okay? Okay. Okay. So actually, you know, to get the idea of seeing things like an illusion, we have to backtrack and talk all about how to meditate on emptiness first. But still, I think it can be good, you know, during the day, if something is happening to us and we're starting to get stirred up, to just say to ourselves, this is an appearance to my mind. You know, I find it very helpful, even if I don't have an understanding of emptiness, to just say, this is an appearance to my mind. That just helps not to take the thing as being so real and so strong. Yeah? Geshe Thichuk likes to use the example of a television. Yeah? When you look at the TV screen, it looks like there's all these people there. Yeah? And at a certain time, you know, while we're watching the screen, we experience all sorts of emotions because at some level we're relating to that image as if there were real people there. Aren't we? Yeah? But when we remind ourselves it's just an image on the screen, you know, I don't need to be so emotional towards this. It's that thing is not really happening here in front of me. There's nobody really getting hurt, you know. Then it's just an appearance on the screen. Then that lessens, you know, our involvement with it. Okay? So that can be helpful during the day, just to remember, you know, it's just an appearance to my mind. And even if we don't understand emptiness per se, we're beginning to see how much our mind projects unrealistic things on people. Okay? So even if we're grasping the person is truly existent, all the unrealistic junk that we're piling on top of that, even if we think that is just an appearance to my mind, that will help us. Okay? This person that seems determined to, you know, grind me into the ground. Yeah, that's just an appearance to my mind. I don't really know what that person's motivation is. And even if they were trying to grind me into the ground, why do I need to get angry about it? Okay. So the second line refers to the technique for establishing the lack of true existence of the consciousness which apprehends things in such a way. Okay? So this one says, yeah, that you're meditating on the emptiness of the consciousness. Okay, the apprehending consciousness. We often talk about the subject, the consciousness, and the object, the thing that's being apprehended. So here, when it says examine the nature of unborn awareness, it's looking at the emptiness of the mind. Yeah, the mind that's the subject, that's perceiving objects. Okay, and so that mind is not truly existent. What in the world does that mean, that the mind isn't truly existent? Yeah. Because it seems like there's just a plain old real mind there. Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. There's one unified thing that's my mind. That's it. Yeah. That's the way it seems, doesn't it? But when we examine, is there one unified thing that is my mind? You know, if I were to look, you know, how can I identify something that spans over an incredible period of time as one unified thing, because actually it has parts. It has different moments, doesn't it? And isn't the mind changing moment by moment? Is one moment of mind the same as the next moment of the mind? So when we look, you know, at first it seems like there's just mind, that's it. But when we start investigating, what exactly does the word mind refer to? You know, does it refer to this moment of mind, or that moment of mind, or this moment of mind? Or does it refer to the primary consciousness, or to one of the mental factors? You know, where is something that I can hang my key on and say this is the mind when I actually search and investigate? Yeah. There's nothing there that we can say is, you know, the mind. There's just a series of moments of clarity and awareness. Yeah? That exist depending upon the object that they're cognizing. Because you also can't find a mind without finding an object that's being cognized. Yeah? Because we have this idea of there's the mind, okay? Here's the mind, and it's just sitting all alone by itself. It isn't cognizing anything. Yeah? It's just a mind in and of itself. And here's an object in and of itself. And perception is they bump into each other. Yeah? But how can you identify something that is a mind without having an object that's being cognized by that mind? How are you going to identify a moment of mind if that mind isn't cognizing something? Yeah? Because that's the whole function of mind, is to cognize. So it's not like it's sitting there all by itself as a truly existent mind and then bumps into an object. Okay? Each moment arises independent upon the object and the sense organ, the previous moment of consciousness, all those things coming together, then you get a moment of mind. Yeah. And then plus you have all these different moments of mind. So where's this independent thing that is a mind? Yeah? That's just sitting out there in Never Never Land, waiting for an object to come along for it to cognize. Yeah? You begin to see that such a thing can't exist. Can't exist. And so then you begin to see that the mind is actually dependent. Yeah? Each moment of mind that arises depends on the object, depends on the sense power, depends on a previous moment of mind. Yeah? So it exists because its causes existed. The causes, you know, produced it. It's there. And then it goes out of existence and produces something else as it's going out of existence. Yeah? But there's a continuity of mind. So then we get into thinking, well, then the mind is like a film strip. And each moment of mind is this separate little frame, you know, like the old movies. Yeah, there's so many frames and they're just going so fast that it looks like a continuum. Then we start to think, oh, well, yeah, there's this moment of mind, it's sitting next to this one, sitting next to this one, and sitting next to this one. But it's not. How are you going to define one isolated moment of mind that is a unity in and of itself, that is without parts? Yeah, this is one frame that has no connection to the previous moment of mind and no connection to the next moment of mind. How can you identify something, find something like that? So you know, just think about that. You know, how we conceptualize that the moments of mind as discrete frames, and can such a thing exist? Yeah? Okay. So when we look like this, we can't find one thing that is a mind from its own side, unrelated to anything else. Unrelated to objects, unrelated to sense powers, unrelated to previous moments. Okay, then, the third line indicates the means for comprehending the lack of true existence, even of yourself, the investigator. Okay, so the third line is the remedy itself is released in its own place. Actually, if we go back to the first line, consider all phenomena as a dream, one way of talking about that is that that's talking about the emptiness of external objects. Yeah, seeing all phenomena as a dream is expressing the emptiness of external objects. Examine the nature of unborn awareness is looking at the emptiness of the cognizing mind. And then the third line, the remedy itself is released in its own place, is looking at the emptiness of the self. Okay. But there's also another tradition that says that third line means that you're looking at the emptiness of emptiness as well. Okay? So we'll explain it in both ways. Okay? So the remedy itself is released in its own place. If we take that to mean, to refer to the emptiness of the self, okay, the person who's merely labeled independence upon the body and mind, then at that time, you know, we would meditate on the emptiness of the self and try and identify, you know, try and inquire how the self exists and see if we can identify some kind of objectifiable basis there that is the self, you know, when we search. And so that would get us into the four-point analysis, investigating what is the self. Is it the body? Is it the mind? Is it something separate from the body and mind? Okay. So, and then another way of seeing this line, the remedy itself is released in its own place, is that emptiness is the remedy, and emptiness itself is empty. And we'll get into this a little bit later, because some people misunderstand and think of emptiness as some reified absolute that doesn't depend on anything. Okay, so that's another mistake that we can easily fall to. Yeah. And that's why I don't like translating it absolute truth, because absolute gives the idea that it is unrelated to anything else. And we could easily start seeing emptiness as some kind of absolute phenomena there that's just unrelated to anything. Yeah. But emptiness also exists conventionally. It exists by being merely labeled. It has parts. You know, it isn't something that's unrelated. Because to have emptiness, you have to have an object that is empty. Yeah, we can't talk about the emptiness of an object that doesn't exist. Well, you can talk about it, but it doesn't have any meaning. Okay? Okay. And then the next line, place the essence of the path on the nature of the basis of all. Okay, so it says the last line refers to the process of safeguarding your meditative equipoise through meditation free from laxity and excitement on the meaning of what is not found by analysis. Okay? So that last line is the foundation of all is emptiness. And so place the essence of the path, you know, on the nature of the basis of all means put your concentration on emptiness, and put it on emptiness in a way so that your concentration is free from laxity and free from excitement. And so that actually would get us into the whole topic of how to develop serenity. Okay? And that's a whole other discussion. So we're just going through these lines very quickly here because there's more explanation of emptiness to come. But this is just kind of a preview. Okay, and so what happens when you're meditating on emptiness is first you try and get just the correct understanding, okay? And then once you have the correct understanding, you try and really meditate and do the meditation, okay? And you gain the first thing you gain is an inferential realization of emptiness. And you try and focus on that as best as you can, you know, using the serenity. And then in the time when you come out of that meditation, then you're practicing seeing things as like an illusion. And over a period of time of meditating, having the inferential realization of emptiness, eventually the conceptual appearance that's allowing you to realize emptiness inferentially fades away, and you get a direct perception of emptiness. Yeah, and emptiness is, you know, then they say that the mind is fused with emptiness like water poured in water. And when you wake up from that meditative equipoise, then again, you know, you practice seeing things as like an illusion. Yeah. But of course, how things are going to appear when you're thinking of them like an illusion, it's going to be different when you've had an inferential realization versus when you have a direct realization. You know, that's going to be different. And then that's going to still be different when you've eliminated all the afflictions, like on the eighth bhumi, and you're still in your break time seeing things as like an illusion. Okay. Oh, okay, we'll just do the next part. The way to examine the view outside the meditation session is indicated by the line, in between meditation sessions, be like a conjurer, okay? Or in the meditation break, be a creator of illusion. Yeah. So just as a conjurer feels no attachment for the illusions he creates, a meditator, after arising from meditation on emptiness, has no attachment to appearances. This will be taught later. These are no more no less than the techniques for meditating on the ultimate awakening mind, according to the words of the great teacher Chekhova. So he put a whole huge topic in those five lines, or six lines. Okay? So the idea there's a very interesting example with a conjurer, but maybe we'll get into that later. How the conjurer isn't deceived by the things that they conjure up. Yeah.
Can you explain what they're meaning when they say the basis is the foundation of all, that emptiness is the foundation of all?
Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to say emptiness is the foundation of all? In that everything is empty of inherent existence. And remember, we were saying that things exist within emptiness in the sense that everything is empty? Mm-hmm. Okay? So you can call it the foundation of all in the sense that everything is empty. And it's impossible for anything to exist without emptiness existing. So it doesn't mean foundation of all, like some real thing, and out of that stuff comes. Okay? Okay. Yeah?
It's not very well formed, but I can't because I can't figure out what I'm trying to ask exactly. But we talk about the illusion and the conjurer, and that I get a sense of phenomena being ethereal or evanescent. But then there seems a very clear distinction between that and persons. And in almost a way that it makes me feel that persons are more real, because most of our karma is created with persons, and even like within the Vinaya, certain vows you break whether or not you know there's an actual person involved or not. It's like whether or not you're aware that there's an actual person there, you still. And then there's other vows where if you're not aware of that, then.
No, you always have to have an object.
You
may not identify it correctly. Yeah.
So even though you, from your own side, don't realize that there's a person there, it still affects the karma, which gives me the sense that somehow persons are more real or exist in some way more. More real than objects.
Yeah. Okay. So this is interesting because what he's saying is it seems like external things are more ephemeral, than persons, because persons seem so real to us. Yeah, and I remember talking with one of my teachers about that one time, because they always say that meditating on the selflessness of persons is an easier approach at the beginning than meditating on the selflessness of phenomena. And I was questioning that because I said exactly what you're saying, that I can look and, I know things are, just molecules and atoms and that they just come together and there's an appearance of an object, but there's only molecules and atoms there and none of them is the object. That I know. But people, on the other hand, seem really real. And really important. And especially me, when I think me, it seems so real and important. And my teacher was explaining that it just in, and I wonder sometimes how much it has to do with our education and the fact that we grew up with a scientific education where everything is being broken down into ever increasingly small particles without, so far, finding any basis. And according to Majjhimika, you're never going to find the smallest particle at all. Okay, although some scientists are still looking for it. Okay, but, I wonder how much of our perception is having grown up with that view. Yeah? Because we just take it for granted when you look at, atoms, molecules, they're so small. There's actually more space in this thing than there is mass. We kind of learn that, even when we're little. Yeah, whereas a person is like, me! And I wonder sometimes how much that sense of me again comes from our culture, because we're such an individualistic culture. And our whole way of conceiving ourselves is as an independent entity. Whereas, for example, in Asian culture, when you think of the I, it's an I that's embedded in a unit of other people, in the family unit, in the clan unit, in the, national unit. It's the I is a dependent one that's embedded, whereas our sense of I is like, I'm so independent and like, forget all of you. I'm going to go off and do what I want. You can't tell me what to do. And, I can do whatever I want. And I'm going to pick myself up by my own bootstraps. And, So I wonder sometimes how much this, if this is dependent on just the view we've gotten from our culture. But anyway, my teacher was saying that, it's technically easier to see how the the self is dependent in the sense that you can't identify a person without some aspect of that person appearing to you. So we can't say somebody is coming until their body, we see their body, or hear their voice, yeah, or maybe smell their phenomes or whatever it is, yeah. But we always have to have some contact with some aspect of the person, some aspect of the basis of designation, in order to see that a person is there. Yeah. So in that way, they say that it's easier to see that the person is imputed. I'm not here talking about Prasangika's way of being merely imputed, but just that the person is dependent on the aggregates, and anything that is dependent is going to be less solid, less concrete. Yeah? And so that's why they say that meditating on the selflessness of persons is easier. Okay. But again, like I said, I wonder how much our feeling is due to the way we've been brought up in our culture. What do the rest of the people think? What seems more real to you? People or external objects?
People.
People?
Yeah. Every time I've read that thing about it, it's easier to do it the opposite way. I've had that question too.
Like, yeah.
Why would it be easier?
Yeah.
I think it's actually easier when doing the meditation if you're not on the person, because I don't know, I think it's because our perceptions and things are so screwy that when we see that, we can kind of throw it out, whereas when I look at the matter is like still there. There's nothing that's easy for me to throw out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I look at the things that I, you know, kind of toss out in my mind,
mm-hmm.
I say delusions, you know, when you realize, wow, that was deluded. Then you can kind of toss that out and it makes things feel less real, whereas with objects for me,
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, objects. Uh-huh.
Kind of on the same line, I thought that when you're trying to do the meditation on selflessness of person, for me, it's easier to keep what to negate clear in my mind,
mm-hmm.
whereas with matter, that's it's harder.
It's harder,
yeah.
Okay.
And I think it's the emotional. I mean, I can get the sense of
mm-hmm.
when I'm feeling really mean and strong, I can keep that in my mind
mm-hmm.
so I know.
Yeah, so you can sometimes get the sense of inherent existence better when you think of a person, because we're so attached to ourselves. And so that could make the meditation easier to do.
Well, I think, at least when I'm meditating on parts,
mm-hmm.
taking things apart by parts, external objects is much easier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And it's interesting, because when they first explain, let's say, the four-point analysis, or when Chen Rezi does his 7 points, he always first explains it in relationship to a cart or a chariot, some kind of
action.
Chandrakirti.
Chandrakirti.
Yeah. No, on my spell check, I have different things that I do that are, you know, the auto thing. So one is for Chandrakirti, one's for Chen Rezi. Ones, but they're all very close. So, so Chandrakirti, you know, does that. So, you know, maybe understanding it, you know, getting the general understanding is easier in relationship to an object, but getting the realization is easier in relationship with the person. But then it is something to explore, yeah. But we definitely, I think, would have a much more emotional sense and reified sense of people, yeah. Unless we're thinking of our body, we can get pretty reified thinking of our body, yeah.
I found that when you talked about parts, and I told you how looking at my career, It was actually a really good example, because it was like it had become an entity. And so it was easy. I mean, it was the first time I had an experience like that, breaking the concept.
Mm-hmm.
Like we do with democracy.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So she, I'll just tell the people, and then, that you had been meditating on your career because your career was a really important thing, and you were a physical therapist, and you did it for so many years, and you were really good at it, and that was your identity and, you know, your career. But then when you started looking and asking yourself, well, what is a career? You know, is it going to work every day? Is it knowing the material? Is it helping that person or this person or the other person? You know, is it learning different things? What exactly is this career that has been such a significant part of my life that, you know, and as a foundation of my identity, and the whole thing kind of fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she realized there's nothing there to hang on to as, you know, my career. Okay, we're going to have to stop now, at least.
I'm not sure if what I asked got conveyed.
Uh-huh.
Because for me, actually, I very much feel that meditating on the persons is easier.
Mm.
And I think the reason is that I feel like the sense of self is, well, I guess kind of what you're saying, is put on top of the aggregates. It's
mm-hmm.
like saying that it's easier for me to say that there is no cup there. But in saying that there is no real cup there, I don't have to actually negate the physical basis for it. I just understand that what I'm seeing, you know, I'm putting more on there than is really there.
Mm-hmm.
But I can still hold the physical basis as being truly existent without having to go that far, you know.
Because uh-huh.
I can see that I decide that I use that to drink water, and I decide that. So I find that in the same way that the self, the myself, at least, I don't know about meditating on other people's selves, I don't know. So with myself, it seems put on top of the aggregates.
Uh-huh.
But what my question sort of is that it seems like almost like we're being taught in a sense that the persons are more real because we do create karma in regards to them in a much different way than we create karma in regards to objects.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if I go punch a wall,
mm-hmm.
I'm not creating the same karma that if I go punch a person. It's
mm-hmm.
very much stronger karma if I punch a person.
Yeah.
So it seems like somehow we're differentiating between the two.
Mm.
We're obviously differentiating the two. I mean, because we meditate on self and we are
mm-hmm.
persons and phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
But when we make that distinction, it almost seems as though the persons are more, have more essence.
Okay.
Okay.
So what you're saying is that because most of the karma we create is in relationship to people, it seems like people are stronger and weightier and more truly existent somehow.
More essence, I guess.
Yeah, more essence, because those are the things that are, you know, that provoke our attachment and our hatred, you know. Not, you know, the tissues isn't going to provoke such strong emotion as you know, another person will because of our attachment, you know, and so on. And so you're saying for that reason, then it seems like persons are more important or maybe more truly existent or something like that. I think what it is just that, well, you know, on a conventional level, yeah, other people are very important, you know, because they're feeling sentient beings. And we're practicing to help people, to help sentient beings, you know, not to get the clock enlightened, you know. And so the major emphasis in our life is really our relationship with people rather than the relationship with objects in that sense, you know. Of course, you know, then you get the person who's more attached to objects than they are to people. Yeah. But then it's always founded on the attachment to themselves and therefore attached to the objects that please the self. Yeah, so people are very important. And so maybe in that way, because we talk more about them, then they seem more real. Yeah, but you know, it's not that things have different grades of true existence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They don't have any true existence. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Iram Guru Brahma Mandala Kamiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Tara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tens and gifts of generosity, may it stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions. And especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West. For